going on out there, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And I can't do this alone. I have to have help. And the help I have today is unique. It has one leg, a thick neck, gray facial hair, and a thinning bald spot on top. It's Kyle Filiofils.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I am here. Thank you for the compliments, bro. After I just dropped off moose meat for you, you got to give me the
shout-out to the step for the moose meat.
That's right. Once again, my cousin went moose hunting in Alaska and gave me and Cam a whole bunch of meat.
We're going to have to go. We're going to have to break down and go.
I want to go simply to see.
Just for photography reasons alone?
The skies at night. He was talking to him. I was just talking to him again like a week ago. That's when he dropped off the moose meat. And he was talking about the stars up there, the Aurora Borealis. Yeah. I mean, just cool stuff I've always wanted to see.
Let's go.
I'm not going to lie, though. He did see rather large bears again.
Yeah.
And
well, didn't they lose one like a couple of years ago to a bear?
Yeah, they shot
one or two.
They shot one moose. Well, they shot two moose, but they shot one of the moose they shot. It was kind of late at night and they had been hiking around all day and they were tired. They're like, let's just go get some sleep. Let's go get some food and we'll come back in the morning. When they came back in the morning, there were two grizzlies on it and half was gone. They consumed like 800 pounds of meat. In like 4 hours.
You know what's not cool about that? You're made out of the same stuff.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like normally when I'm camping, sometimes my beard or something will rub on the tent and I get scared.
We've established
when
that.
When I'm in bear country, dude, I'm going to be like Don Knotts when he's like shaking with the gun.
Shakiest gun in the West.
And they're like, are you cold? No, I'm scared.
There's monsters out here.
Bears are real.
Yeah. Well, and you and I have talked
about.
And
when I mean that real, I know people know they're real. I mean, they're real dangerous. You ever see Grizzly Man?
Yeah, it doesn't end well.
He thought he was friends with them. And I'm like, man, just because you make friends with the fox, it's not like making friends with grizzly bears. I don't think they – see, that's the thing. People think that some of these pets, like, really love them. Like,
they feel like we feel.
My snake loves me. And I'm like, no, it don't.
Your dog might love you. That grizzly bear doesn't love you.
And a grizzly bear basically is a big dog.
Yeah. Except it eats us. I'm not made out of dog food.
I'm not going to be like the revenant. Like the minute the bears hit the tents, I'm
you're checking out. You're checking out. Yeah. I still want to go.
Oh yeah, I want to go. I'm not going to let that ruin my fun.
No, we need to go. We've talked about it and talked about it. We need to break down and go. It would be fun.
Because I mean, I like new experiences. I'm getting to an age where like you start thinking like how much longer do I have time? Not that I'm going to be dead soon, but there does going to come a point where I'm not going to be physically able to go do anything I want. Like
I feel like I'm halfway. Don't you?
I feel that way. Yeah.
I feel like I'm halfway through the race. Like I can see the finish line. That's being optimistic given the age that my grandparents, great grandparents and parents, the ages that they've all hit.
Yeah.
So if I go off of that, I could be here late 80s to mid 90s is kind of what they go for. So I just turned 46. So it's safe to say that I'm like, probably halfway at this point.
Yeah, I just turned 45. And don't forget, I have the human cockroach bloodline.
That's true.
Flowing through my veins.
Dude, you might live to be 100.
So I think I've got at least 15 lives left.
That's true. That's true.
Right?
How is the old human cockroach?
He's doing good, man. He's made a full recovery. I really thought when he fell and broke his leg in New Jersey.
We had this discussion.
That I didn't think he would. You know, off air, I was like, man, I think that's the end of his walking days. He might go downhill quick after this. But no.
He bounced back.
He's bounced back. I don't know if he's just super tough or just so darn stubborn.
Both.
Yeah. We went over there.
And he doesn't want you to enjoy happiness. He likes to be a burden. He likes to give you a hard time as much as he can.
He's an energy vampire.
Colin Robinson.
I was over there Tuesday night. My mom called us up and said, hey, I'm making some eggplant parmesan. You want to come over? Sure. Went over there and me and him hung out on the back patio. We watched deer, turkey, and I watched him smoke a cigar.
You took him on, didn't you?
Yeah, I always do.
Yeah.
My mom... She's okay with it sometimes, but like other family members, they get mad. I'm like, what are you? Him getting cancer now is like the least of his problems.
Right.
I mean, he's 70 and he's had a hard 70.
Yeah. It's been a hard road to get to 70. Let him smoke. Let him drink.
I mean, it's a horrific illness. And I've lost many family members to the disease. My wife's father just passed away in January of cancer. But look, when you get in your 70s, if you get it then, in my opinion, I'm just like, look, you've lived your life.
You've had a good run? Is that what you're saying?
I think we all kind of forget you're not supposed to live forever.
Yet not everybody's meant to be here the whole time.
Like going back as just four or five generations ago, you would be considered an old, old man at 45.
Dude, my ankle thinks that way right
now. That's true, right? Like you lived in the Old West and you were 30. You're like, dude, you're a senior citizen.
Yeah, tell us about the good old days, Granddad.
You started having a family when you were like 12. You know?
You was on your own working full time when you were 6 years old.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever think about like when you're just out driving around, like, man, what was it like here 200 years ago?
I think about it every
time. And you think your life
trip
is hard. Imagine how hard it was for them.
Yeah, true.
Inking out of life, no grocery stores, and you got to fight off, you know, native combatants and wildlife and everything else.
True story.
And illness.
Yeah.
And I mean,
I got something you can't fight off.
Boredom.
Pale crawlers.
Oh, here we go.
Here we go.
All right. So, yeah, tell me about it.
Of course, Lon loves to share pale crawlers because we all have a fascination with strange and unusual. Listen to this, folks. It says this happened in October of 2020 in Pelham and Helena, Alabama, as I live near the border of the two towns and followed it into Helena from Pelham. I want to be as detailed as possible since my interaction with this thing was over an hour and a half.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, right.
Who hangs out that long?
With one of these.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out.
It's been bugging me a long time, and as much as I try to rationalize what happened, well, I can't. I will try my best to tell my story and hope someone will maybe have a similar incident happen to them and will be able to give a better understanding of this. So I'm living with my girlfriend in Pelham, Alabama. We live together in a development. We were playing video games and relaxing late, around 1 a.m. I can get the exact dates and times if anyone was interested, it says here. But anyway, I go outside to smoke a cigarette. Here we go again, Philly.
Yeah. And I got to take up smoking just so I can see some weird stuff.
Just so I can see cool stuff. How come the cigarette companies haven't picked up on this and they're using it in their ad? Like, right? Like there ought to be some sort of like, isn't there still cigarette ads in books or magazines? Or are they not even allowed to do ads
anymore? I don't think they're even allowed to do it in magazines. That's a good question. The reason I said it is I haven't even seen a magazine in years.
Yeah. That tells you the strength of cigarettes, right?
My father.
People are still buying them.
My father still has a subscription to like National Geographic magazine, like Guns and Ammo magazine.
I'm not surprised on either one.
And some other hunting magazine. I mean, he literally still gets magazines. He still gets the newspaper.
That's why he can never die. He's an energy vampire. That's how this works. Anyhow, they go outside to smoke a cigarette. Says, I hear a woman yell, "Someone help me." As I live in a development, I think nothing of it. Okay. But it continues, and I become curious that the yelling continues for over 5 minutes.
Yeah, if you hear a neighbor yelling, a woman at night, at 1 a.m, that somebody please help me, you might.
Help me, somebody help me.
You might want to go investigate.
You don't want to go, oh, I live around a bunch of houses, this is normal. No, man, it's not.
Maybe he didn't bring up the fact that he hates that neighbor. He's real nosy, and he's been hoping something bad happens for years.
Puts your trash out the night before the dogs get into it, scattered around. Not like my neighbors that do the exact same thing.
Continue.
So it says it continues, but I become curious as the yelling continues, and it says I became a little concerned. So I start to pay closer attention to it, and I believe the yelling is coming from across the main road of my development, in a small patch of woods. So I'm thinking, is it a fox? As they make an almost identical sound to a woman. Granted, they make like that, but they don't say, "Someone help me."
Yeah.
I don't care how long you've hung out with a fox.
Is that a left-handed cigarette you were smoking?
Right? Yeah, no joke. They're smoking that cigarette wet. So it says it continues to scream, and I'm trying to make sure I'm hearing this right. Then it screams, "Please help. And please, someone help." Okay, so here they start talking about this is clear, and I'm sure now that it's not a fox.
Maybe it's a furry, like the one was identifying with the fox.
Maybe so. As I approach closer, because I think someone needs help, but the screams are moving away from me out of the small patch of forest next to the road down the street about 50 yards to another development. So I enter the development, and now I'm 90% sure this is someone's TV or someone has a Halloween decoration that's making this sound, but it's bothering me. I'm now walking in this development, and I text my girlfriend about what happened just in case someone did need help, but it was probably nothing. So I'm trying to follow this screaming as it continues almost 2 or 3 times a minute. Always the same phrases, "Please help me," and "Someone help."
As I'm walking down the road, it seems more difficult to follow, and it seems to be coming from much further away now. So, I decide to just go home. If someone needed help, I thought, why would they be running so fast as they would have to be cover, or as they would have to cover this distance? So as I'm walking back home after 4 or 5 minutes, well, it starts up again, much more loudly, and I now have a much better idea that this is coming from the larger forest near a cell phone tower. So I'm now hearing the screams in the woods about 50 yards from me. I'm standing on the street, and as I'm listening to this, I notice that it's moving quickly parallel to me. So it moves 50 yards to my right, it stops, then screams, "Help me," then runs about another 50 yards to my left.
Something's toying with them.
Exactly. I'm baffled that anyone could move so quickly, and this went on for 5 minutes. It only stopped to speak and run again. This didn't make any sense to me in any way. I wasn't sure if I could enter the forest and try and help this person, but I still couldn't see it, almost as if it was crawling as I saw the bushes moving and heard the twigs snapping along with the screaming. Then it screamed a different phrase, over and over. It screamed, "Why aren't you helping me?" It did this rapidly for almost 2 minutes. Then it made a different noise. It started making a very low, almost grunting noise. This is when I became terrified. I couldn't rationalize this. I'm hearing the woman screaming and this low grunting, growling noise over and over and over. I realize this isn't my imagination. This is insane. I then realize how far I am from my house and how long this had been going on for. I thought that this thing wants me to come into the forest. It isn't running back and forth at the 50-yard distance anymore. It's almost running back and forth 20 yards and very close to me. It refuses to leave the woods, but wants me to come in. The grunting becomes way more frequent, along with its movements, running faster and faster back and forth. I think I see something human-like crawling low to the ground, white or pale in color. It's hard to tell, and it's moving quick. I'm also scared because the grunting was terrifying. I stopped and decided to call 911.
Good idea.
I know whatever this thing was, it wasn't friendly. I've never heard of this happening to anyone, and that's not good. I tell the 911 operator where I am and that there's a woman screaming. Once the Helena Police Department show up, it stops. The police found no trace of anything. Now, I'm pretty terrified just to go outside at night now, and I never believed something like this could exist. It's really messing with my head. See?
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like something was playing with them, you know, trying to trick them, lure them. You hear this a lot from stories of puckwudgies and
it's
stuff
so
like
wild,
that.
They're
though. Like tricksters.
Like it.
It was trying to lure him away.
But think about them. It lured him a long ways off.
Yeah.
And then doubled back to try to cut him, to draw your attention before you could get back home.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It knew it wouldn't chase it. So it was going to let him chase me until he gives up. Then I'm going to double back and get in between him and the house and start trying to lure him over there.
Man, that is creepy.
That's predator intelligence is what that is. And that is very, very unnerving.
Yeah, because it shows you something has a lot of intelligence to know how to do that, manipulate.
And it's predatory.
Yeah.
Predators do that. That's what they're looking to do, is to lull you into it.
Well, you know, and perhaps this is what's happening with all these missing people that David Pilatus writes about, is maybe these people that are out hunting or hiking, they hear the call for help, they go to investigate, and then... They're gone forever.
That's right. Vanished.
Right? Check this out. It says, "Hey guys, I've recently found your podcast and I've been binge listening over the past few weeks. You've easily become one of my favorite podcasts."
Well, thank you so very much.
"I have just started listening to the episode called Vile Vortices from 2017.
Word.
And the first story you talk about is about a pterodactyl sighting in West Yorkshire, England, in the early 1980s. And I had to pause the episode to go write you this email. I was surprised to hear that the first man you mentioned had his encounter at a place called Shipley Glen, which is just 10-minute drive from where I live. This sparked a memory I had kind of forgotten about from a few years ago. I don't know when exactly. At a guess, I would say it was around 2007 or 2008, Me and my boyfriend at the time, we have been around 18 or 19 years old, were at a local park when my boyfriend pointed at the sky and asked, "What is that?" We both looked up and saw something huge flying across the sky. We only saw it for a few seconds, but I distinctly remember us calling it a dinosaur. It silently glided away behind a tree, and we both lost sight of it. We both looked at each other in surprise, and we both agreed we had just seen what we thought looked like a pterodactyl. We tried to see if we could spot it again, but it had already gone, and we never heard it make a noise. Imagine my surprise when your podcast went on to say that after the initial pterodactyl sighting that was reported at Shipley Glen, a woman reported seeing the same creature flying over the town of Yeadon and towards Leeds and Bradford Airport. Yeadon just happens to be my hometown.
Ooh.
And is exactly where me and my boyfriend were in the park when we thought we had seen a pterodactyl a couple of years ago. I'm not saying that we actually saw a pterodactyl.
I am.
In fact, over the years, I've talked myself into believing it was probably just a heron that we saw flying across the sky. But I remember it being huge and thinking, oh, my God, that's a dinosaur. Now, hearing those reports on your podcast and one of them literally being in the town I live in and where we had our sighting makes me wonder if maybe we did see something prehistoric in the skies over our sleepy countryside town. Thanks, Carol.
Wow. Very cool, right?
Carol, thank you. That's awesome. Look, you're part of the flap.
Right.
No pun intended. You're part of the pterodactyl flap.
And it's just what a eureka moment to have seen something crazy and then just kind of forget about it. And then years later, you hear a podcast somewhere from two
knuckleheads
in Texas reporting a sighting in the same town that you saw that thing. And what's the chances of that? Right? Yeah.
You had an encounter. You saw a pterodactyl.
Now I will say,
I have seen
drones that look like pterodactyls. I don't know if they're around in 2007, but I have seen them. I've seen them also where they look like witches and they mm-hmm. chase people in the park. And so I've also seen kites that look like pterodactyls. So I'm not trying to disprove the sighting. I'm saying, could it have been one of those or could it have been a pterodactyl, a pteranodon?
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
What seems crazier? Would it be harder to, let me see how I'm going to word this. Do you think that you would be fooled to think it was a kite? Like, what's more unbelievable, that you got fooled by a kite or that it was a real pterodactyl?
What's more believable?
Yeah.
That you got fooled by a kite.
So,
I mean, that's just my skeptical mind.
So let's say it's the kite, right? Let's say that's what they saw was a kite.
Sure.
How does three different people see it in three different areas in two different towns?
Yeah. I mean, unless they all saw the same kite.
You can't see the same kite. You couldn't see the same kite in a town 10-minute drive from us.
Man, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Unless that guy just happens to go around from park to park.
Yeah. And if that's, true, I hope that guy gets hit by a bus.
You know what else is odd, though, is like the sightings, like this one she mentions, made no sound. So, how many times have we heard of sightings in the sky where it makes absolutely no sound?
Yeah.
The other thing, what I'm trying to talk about is the descriptions are of what we thought pterodactyls used to look like. Mm-hmm. Now a lot of scientists are coming forward and saying they probably had feathers.
Yep.
Or they've proven that several types of them did have feathers. So how come people don't see that? Why are they seeing something that looks like what you think it should look like rather than what it actually looks like? What I'm saying?
Well, that's because then it becomes a tulpa. You've created a thought form
right. That
so many people, just like we've talked about with the history of the Slender Man, we've talked about all these crazy sightings, maybe Dog Man, these could be thought forms.
Yeah.
And the reason they don't make sound is they're not physical.
Very cool. Thanks for sending the story in.
Extremely cool.
Before we get to the main segment of the show, we had a caller recently call in and tell us this crazy story. This comes from a guy named Jake in San Diego, and he had an odd experience while working late one night in a hotel. Check this out.
Hey, my name's Jake from San Diego. Feel free to say that on your own, I don't care. Probably about 10, 11 years ago, I worked at a hotel in downtown San Diego, and it was a brand new hotel, fresh built from basically the third floor up. It was originally a bank, but nothing above the third floor. And we had our maintenance shop up on the 20th floor. It was originally going to be the owner's suite, but he ran out of money, and this was never finished, so we just stored all of our parts and miscellaneous junk in there and everything and made it our shop. And I did mainly kitchen maintenance, so I worked overnights because that's when the kitchens were closed. And so it was probably about 1:32 in the morning. Me and a coworker were there. He was in the pass down phase where he was telling me what was going on his shift to get me ready for mine, yada, yada, yada. And our shop took up the whole side of the building. So there's two entrances into it. One of them we had blocked off with some shelves that had parts and flush valves and things like that on it. The other one was where we came in and out. And then there was a loft in there as well. So kind of a two-level room. And on the loft was where our computer was and kind of the office area. And so we were sitting up in the office area talking, and we hear bang, bang, bang on the door that's blocked. And so I mean, that's weird. I go out and I look. Nobody in the hallways or anything like that. All three of our elevators were at the ground floor. So I call down to our front desk and I ask, you know, is anybody staying on the 20th floor or 19th floor, thinking a kid was just, you know, banging around or something. And front desk says, no, nobody's staying above the 18th floor. All right, whatever, you know, maybe we just misheard something. So I go back up to our office area. We're sitting there, and about 20 minutes later, we hear it again, bang, bang, bang on the same door. And I go out there to look again, don't see anything. The elevators are still on the ground floor. I radio down to security and say, hey, you know, we're hearing these noises up here. Is there, you know, somebody on video that goes and runs into the stairwell or, you know, anything like that? Security reviews footage, don't see anything. So kind of just talking up to be whatever. And then probably another 20, 30 minutes later, right as my coworker is about to leave for the night, we hear the bang, bang, bang on the same door again. But this time it's so firm and hard that it actually knocks some flush valves off the shelf. And so I instantly run out there. I look, don't see anything. The elevator's still on the ground floor. As I'm running out there, I radio to security, you know, what's going on? There's elevators ground floor. There's no one in the stairwells. All of our lights and everything are fine. You know, there's nobody in any of the rooms. And security calls me and like, hey, you should come down here. So I go down to the security, which is down in our basement, and he shows me the video. And about the time that we heard the banging, you could see this black mist shape kind of thing that's probably about halfway up the door to the top of the door, and it moves away from the door as I come into the frame looking down the hallway. And there, each door has a little can light above the door shining straight down, and then there's can lights throughout the hallway. So it's not like my shadow's projecting on it or anything, because there's no light shining behind me that direction. It's all shining straight down, essentially. And the shadow mist, whatever you want to call it, you know, it was only that little section, moved about a foot away, 2 foot away from the door, and then just disappeared. I never saw the mist with my own eyes, but from the video, it was right in front of me. And I still have the video somewhere. I have to look and try and find it, mail, email it to you guys. But it was a brand new building. As far as I know, nobody had died during the construction of it or anything at all like that. So I don't know where this ghost or whatever would have come from. And I worked there for another 8 months, never had another experience, but that is my only ghost experience I've ever had, and it was pretty weird. And I have a coworker and security guard from there that corroborated, and you know, one saw the video, the other one heard the banging. So let me get a show. Thanks.
And we're back. Yeah. Very interesting story. You know, this is, I know, how would you, I mean, everybody's been in a building or had a late night job or something where you hear odd sounds. And then to have coworkers be able to back up what they saw on this camera that you weren't aware of, that's got to be a creepy feeling. But anyways, thanks for calling in and telling us the show. Sending it into the show. Sorry, I can't talk.
He's a slight stroke. It's fine. He's been drinking death water all morning. Let's take a quick one. And when we get back, folks, I'm going to be discussing some of the very strange military encounters from not only around the world, but just different eras, right? Different wars in itself and some very odd things that went down. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. There, friends, thanks so much for being here. We are going to jump in to some very strange and unusual military sightings of everything, of just very odd, creepy, disturbing things. And I'm going to kick it off with a really interesting UFO sighting. It took place during the Korean War. What makes this so interesting is a good friend of Mr. J. Allen Hynek was actually the one that did this research. He's the one that interviewed this fella back in 1987. The fella's name is Francis P. Wall. He was a PFC in the U.S. Army, private first class. Now, he was there during the Korean War, and he's been interviewed by Richard Haynes. And Richard Haynes, of course, associate of J. Allen Hynek, and did the work there of what's called the Kuros, which is the Center for UFO Studies there in Chicago. And so this took place back in the 80s. I believe 87 was when this actually fired up. But anyway, so what ended up going down was John sat down and spoke to Private Wall, about an encounter that he had had. This is how it goes. All right, here's you a little writing of it. It says, "This event that I'm about to relate to you is the truth. So help me God. It appeared in the early spring of 1951 in Korea. We were in the Army Infantry, 25th Division, 27th Regiment, 2nd Battalion, Easy Company. We were in what is known on the military maps as the Iron Triangle near Chorwan. It is night. We are located on the slopes of the mountain below which there is a Korean village. Previously, we had sent our men into this village to warn the populace that we're going to bombard it with artillery. On this night, we were doing just that. We had aerial artillery burst coming in. We suddenly noticed on our right-hand side what appeared to be a jack-o'-lantern come wafting down across the mountain. And at first, no one thought anything about it. So we noticed that this thing continued on down to the village to where, indeed, the artillery air bursts were exploding. Now, it had an orange glow in the beginning. We further noticed that this object was so quick that it could get into the center of an airburst of artillery and yet remain unharmed. Now, the time element on this, I would say, was anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour, all told. But then this object approached us, and it turned a blue-green brilliant light. It's hard to distinguish the size of it. There's no way to compare it. The light was pulsating as the object approached us. I asked for and received permission from Lieutenant Evans, our company commander at the time, to fire upon this object, which I did with an M1 rifle with armor-piercing rounds. And I did hit it. It must have been metallic because you could hear when the projectiles slammed into it. Now, why would that bullet damage this craft if the artillery rounds didn't? Well, I don't know. Unless they had dropped their protective field around them or whatever. But the object went wild, and the light was going on and off. It went off completely once, just briefly, and it was moving erratically from side to side as though it might crash to the ground. Then a sound. We had heard no sound previous to this, the sound of, like, diesel locomotives revving up. That's the way this thing sounded. And then we were attacked. We were swept by some form of ray that was emitted in pulses, in waves you could visually see only when it was aiming directly at you. Now, that is to say, like a searchlight sweeps around, and of course you could see it coming at you. Now, you would feel a burning, tingling sensation all over your body, as though something were penetrating you. So the company commander, Lieutenant Evans, hauled us into our bunkers. We didn't know what was going to happen. We were all scared. These are underground dugouts where you have peepholes to look out and to fire at the enemy. So I'm in my bunker with another fella, and we're looking out at the peepholes at this thing. Now, it hovered over us for a while, lit up the whole area with this light. And then I saw it shoot off at a 45-degree angle. Just that quick. Just there, next minute gone, that fast. And it was though that was the end of it. But 3 days later, the entire company of men had to be evacuated by ambulance. They had to cut roads in there and haul them out. They were too weak to walk. They all had dysentery. Then, subsequently, when the doctors did see them, they had an extremely high white blood cell count, which the doctors could not account for. Now, in the military, especially the Army, each day you file a company report. We had a confab about that. Do we file it in the report or not? And the consensus was no, because they'd lock every one of us up and think we were crazy. Now, at that time, no such thing as UFO had been heard of, and we didn't know what it was. I still don't know what it was. But I do know that since that time, I have periods of disorientation, memory loss, and I dropped from 180 pounds to 138 pounds after I got back to this country. And I've had great difficulty keeping my weight up. Indeed, I'm retired and disabled from all this today. What do y'all think about that? So there were actual combat situation against a UFO in Korea. Now, how would you, especially back then, of course, not like we could fight them now. We just got guns. We don't have any crazy space gun, movie gun. We're just fighting aliens with, rifles. It may not always go that way. It doesn't sound like it, but it sounds like his rifle actually did something. Could you imagine flying all this way and having this big special ship only to have some of these primitives down here shoot something with the, shoot a rifle at you and then the bullets pinging around inside there? Oh, that'd be embarrassing, wouldn't it? Completely embarrassing. So we're going to go further back than the Korean War, to the Battle of Chickamauga. I've been to this park, I guess you could say. It's what this is, this area here. I went there. It's on the Tennessee-Georgia border. I went there when I was a kid. We had some family that lived in Georgia, and y'all might remember me talking about it. I went up there and stayed for like a month whenever I was like in junior high. And I went and they took me around, and I got to see a bunch of stuff like that up there. And I remember, I think it's Chickamauga, but who the heck knows? You know how these words go. So there was a sighting of a creature. Now, we've talked about this at length. It's something about the battles, the war, something along those lines that seems to draw the evil to it, or the negative energies or whatever feeds or consumes on these things seems to be pulled and drawn in this area. And we've talked about Gettysburg, did a whole segment on Gettysburg. This battle is the second bloodiest battle in the Civil War, only behind Gettysburg, this Battle of Chickamauga. Now, it took place on the 19th and 20th, 2 days back in September in 1863, near a place called Snodgrass Hill. And it was just, like I said, from the casualties alone, it was a massive, massive war. But so what ended up going down was, of course, the corpses and I don't know if I've talked about this before, but the one thing that was so shocking to me whenever I went to the World War II Museum in New Orleans was the size of the uniforms, how much smaller men of the day were back then. And it holds true even in the Civil War. If you see and go to a museum and you get a chance to see the clothing and all that, you got to see how small they are. Like, we're talking, of course, it's due to food. It's due to a very severe lack of nutrition mostly, but they're not very big. It wasn't like we're talking about what people today, the sizes of people today. No, this looked more like the sizes of, junior high kids, right? Like preteens, early teens, like they're not very big people. So you got to imagine, it's littered, right? This battlefield's littered in bodies. The people don't have the energy, you know, the time. It's not like they're going around picking up bodies and everybody's doing it and they got all this equipment. It's all done by hand, right? You're talking hand digging graves, hand carrying bodies, getting the people that aren't injured enough, you know, and they've also got other jobs. So it is a large undertaking to dispose of bodies. You've seen the photos of the Civil Wars, you know, you've seen all this. So they reported, these military men here reported that after the battle, up near Snodgrass Hill, they would see what they described as a monster. Now, this monster was described very humanoid, very human-like, but that it had a large deformed jaw, and they claim it had fangs, that you could see its teeth protruding out of the lips. It was huge, and that it had green eyes, glowing green eyes to be exact, and that's what they nicknamed it, Green Eyes. And there was more than one report of people seeing this, and that it would make its way through, like, the bodies. Like, right in the evenings, it's moving up through there. Maybe it's feeding. Who knows what was going on, right? So you think, oh, that's it. No big deal, right? That's, people saw it. That was it. Well, as time went on at the National Park, there's more and more encounters that people were coming forward going, man, I saw some crazy stuff over there, right? I saw something with green eyes. I saw these green orbs. I saw this. I saw that. I saw creatures, all of that. So in the 70s, there were two different unrelated actual people there that actually had some kind of sighting, some kind of stuff. Now, here's what's wild. Same location where this sighting went place, same part of the road, two different years. So we're not two different, wasn't even the same year. Two different people, wasn't even the same year. Nothing was close. Same location, nothing remotely close related with these people, except they both saw these glowing green eyes, and they both wrecked their car in this area. Yeah, drove off, right? Drove off the road, crashed it, and both reported because there was a green-eyed something out there. Now, there's a park ranger named Edward Tenney. And back in 1981, Edward Tenney talked about how he was walking through the park about 4 o'clock in the morning. He said this was back in 75, 76. He believes middle of 76. When he said he got this chill all over his entire body. And he said the very next moment, he noticed something moving in the darkness. This is what he was quoted saying. When it passed me, I could see his hair was long like a woman's. The eyes, I'll never forget those eyes. They were glaring, almost greenish orange in color, flashing like some sort of wild animal. The teeth were long and pointed like fangs. I didn't know whether to run or scream or what to do. Then the headlights of an approaching car came blasting through the fog, and the thing disappeared right in front of me. Yeah. So now there's some kind of crazy thing seen that's still there. So we're talking the battle in the 1860s all the way up to now. Still people. Now, I haven't found any of the most recent. And if y'all, man, I would surely, I'm going to have to see if I can send an email to somebody out there, to somebody that, and see if anybody would be willing to talk. That'd be pretty cool to see if anybody would talk about what it was. But it's just interesting that they have still, even, you know, like I said, in the 70s, we're still having some sort of encounter with whatever the heck that was. Now, this one is not necessarily in the middle of the war, but I thought it was a very interesting story nonetheless. About friendship, about, you know, some serious friendship. This one was a little different. This one was actually written up by a fella who was a graduate from Notre Dame. And there's, you know, all of this. It's mainly a lot of Notre Dame graduates. And this was on a Notre Dame blog site. And it is a very interesting story. But it's also sad. It's got a very sad ending. And I'm going to share it with you. Before we go on to anything, any wild or craziness or anything like that, but I want you to listen to this. This was PFC Gerald Lawrence Fox from the U.S. Army in 1967. So PFC Fox was in a firefight July 12th of 67 in Vietnam, and he was killed. He was killed during this firefight. Now, he had a really, really good friend. Now, Gerald was named Jerry. That's what everybody called him. All of his friends called him, all of this stuff. And so this is one of those ones that there's a separation, right, between those with money and those without. So what ended up happening was Jerry went to high school with the fella writing this story. I believe the fella was named William. But so William tells this story about how they had lost touch. Him and Jerry had grown up together. They'd been friends together, all of this stuff. And William said that he had gone off to college, this, that, and the other, found out he didn't know till much later that Jerry had been drafted and that, you know, he was actually in Vietnam. He had no clue of any of this stuff going on. So he goes to tell this story that in the summer of 67, he'd been working there in Manhattan for a little construction job. He said the pay was okay, really good. He goes, but, you know, we worked long hours. It was hard work. He said, so one evening, it was late. He had got off. He had rode the train. He said train called the 6 train. He'd headed towards his parents' place there in Parkchester. And he said Parkchester is the post-World War II housing project in the Bronx. And he said he had about a half a mile walk west to his apartment where he'd grown up. And he's headed back to his folks there on Unionport Road. And he said by his parents' place on the way was a place called Gleason's Funeral Home, directly across the street from St. Helena's Church, where just so happens Jerry and William went to church together as little boys. And Jerry lived with his mom to the east of that train station, the one that he had been on, the train 6. So William goes on to say that he was about a half a block from Gleason's, and he saw a figure walk out of the funeral home and turn and start heading in his direction. He said, now, except for the streetlights, everything was dark. And he said that he was quite sure the person walking towards him was Jerry Fox. Now, he said, I haven't seen Jerry in over 2 years, right? Graduation, life, everything had gone up. And he said, I haven't chatted, nothing. He said, I haven't even thought about him in over 2 years. And I knew when I saw him, like, man, we got a lot of catching up to do. But this is the way it always is. He said, I was too tired. I was too tired to spend quality time with a friend. He said, so as we neared and approached each other, he goes, I just looked down, right? Put my head down, kind of dipped and went on by. Went on by like you wouldn't want your friend to notice who you were because you didn't want to take the time. He said, the minute he walked into his apartment, his mother was standing there. She's on the phone and she turns and looks and tells him that she's speaking to another friend of theirs who called to let him know that Jerry had passed away. Said Jerry got killed in Vietnam. And so she hands him the phone and takes it, starts talking to his buddy John, and said, you know, what are you talking about? And he said, yeah, man. He said, they're going to have a wake for him there tomorrow at Gleason's funeral home. And so William says, well, I sat down and I had to tell John, I just walked past him, and tells the whole story of walking, of seeing him. And he brings up a really good point. And of course, this is heartbreaking when you read this, but he says, to this day, I have refused to forgive myself for having turned my back on a friend. Did I have to stop and shake his hand to know it was Jerry? I know the answer to that, but you tell me. Or better yet, convince me it wasn't Jerry's spirit when for the previous 2 years he'd been out of sight, out of mind. He says, how could it have been a mere coincidence that I saw a figure leaving Gleason's, heading in my direction, and instantaneously thought of Jerry Fox, whose body now rested that very same night inside that funeral home? So he goes on to tell that, you know, the next time it goes on, that or the next day, they went to the wake, went and sought out his mother and spent time with her because, you know, they've known her forever. And the whole deal, come to find out, he was in a very brutal firefight. He was the last of his group to make it, didn't survive it in his company, but he was the last one as they were overran. And goes on to this whole story, but this poor fella still never forgives himself. He said, I can never forgive myself for having done this to my best friend or one of my good friends. But what I was talking about, the difference was he realizes, William realizes, that the only reason that Jerry had to go to Vietnam was because he was raised by a single mother and they didn't have the money to send him to college. And you could get out of going to the draft if you were, you know, had good enough grades and you were in college. And so William was in the college. He was in the University of Notre Dame. And so that's where he feels all that guilt. I feel so bad for this guy. Like, it's a heartbreaking story of, imagine doing that. You would never know, right? You walk, especially then, you know, there's no social media. There's no keeping up with any of that. You walked by your best friend because you are a good friend because you're tired. You're like, look, I'll call him next week or I'll call him this weekend. If anything, that tells us not to waste the chances that we're given. And I'm the world's worst about it. But it's one of those things that we kind of need to, I guess, to really do our due diligence, especially now, to let people know how much we care about them and to just kind of check in on them. And then I come across this. We've talked about some really crazy, creepy stories in Vietnam. And, you know, we've talked about, was it the Aswang? Wasn't it the Aswang? It's one of the crazy vampire stories from down there in the jungle. Man, I can't remember. Yeah, I know that's what it is. But I found this one, and this one is disturbing. This, I'm surprised this story or even this little thread hasn't become a movie. Because back in 1967, it is believed that the U.S. military was involved in not just a war against the Viet Cong, but a war against vampires in a certain area of Vietnam. I'm going to tell you all this because I had no idea. This comes from the Federal Vampire and Zombie Agency. Yeah, that's a thing, and I found it, and it's got some wild stories. Dr. Hugo Pecos is the director. Now, this was written by Luke Castaglioa, and it is a very interesting write-up about Southeast Asian vampires. I'm going to read this to y'all. So what ended up going down is, I said, from the beginning of combat in Vietnam's jungles, and if you're into any kind of war history or military history, you've already known this. If you're not, here's something that you're a little information that you're privy to. One of the main reasons that napalm, a lot of this stuff was invented and used over there, that was, of course, not only just to cause damage, but was to help defoliate the jungle, because the Viet Cong were so good at guerrilla warfare and its tactics, we couldn't find them, right? So there was so many places to hide, and they're on their land, and I mean, it was one of those deals that it's not like any other war we've ever fought. So all of these jungles gave a problem. So the army was trained and equipped for conventional mechanized warfare, like what we talked about in World War II. Vietnam comes along, you can't drive equipment through these jungles. Literally, you're cutting trails with machetes and hiking around in there. It sounds terrible and terrifying all at the same time, right? And like I said, the Viet Cong, masters of their area, masters of the forest, masters of the woods. Like, it is near impossible to find them. And then they had ammo caches, weapon caches in other villages. You know, it was spread out. So it was so rudimentary that we couldn't deal with it. We're used to dealing, you know, like you think about it, you know, fighting the Germans and the Japanese in World War II. They were very technologically advanced at the time. Now you have to imagine these people were keeping it simple. There was no need to be technologically advanced because you're in these jungles. You can easily move the way you've been moving and the trade routes that you've used your whole life and your parents and your grandparents. All of this worked out very, very well for them. So in an attempt to flip this script on the Viet Cong, the Marine Corps developed a Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support known as CORDS program. And they would basically assign very small units of patrolmen to patrol these villages. So the Marines decided to recruit members of indigenous tribes in these mountain regions there in West Vietnam to give them a little help, right? So the Marines finally, they discover pretty quick that these people, these tribes, all of this, they don't go into certain areas of the jungle because of what they called phantoms, or the locals called Ma. So one of the tribes there, they said that they start telling the story of people coming back to life, almost like zombies in the jungle that haunted this certain region, and that they said that these creatures would not only attack you, that they would drink your blood and would eat your, you know, your liver, would pull you apart, pull you open just to get to your internal organs. And of, what do you think we did, right? The U.S. military is like, come on, get out of here with that nonsense. You know, that's not true. So they're not going to listen to any of that stuff. But ends up, it kind of comes out that they're like, wait a minute. We start getting more and more intel of strange encounters going on. So in 1965, they're like, wait a minute. What's going on with this stuff? Now, we're gathering up a lot of these stories. And they start involving troops just seeing glimpses of other, I can't really say people, more like figures moving through the jungle. And it just progressed from there. It went from, what was that? Was that somebody over there? To now we see this thing. What is that? They start describing these things as black-eyed people. Yeah, not kids, folks, black-eyed folks. And you can see their teeth. They, some described them as fangs. Others said, no, they were just baring their teeth. But either way, you can see all this. And then there was soldiers started disappearing from their platoons. People would go missing. Wasn't normal. Now, we could say this was more of the guerrilla warfare, and it could have easily been. Or it could have been something dark, and it goes even darker. A couple of soldiers got into a firefight with a few, and they said that this one of the creatures seemed to be not even phased at all. Like almost bullet, not really bulletproof. It just, if it was hitting them, it was going through them, and they did not care. There was nothing about it. So the U.S. commanders start going, well, wait a minute now. You're telling me that we have vampires loose in the jungle. So one of the military doctors are like, look, there's 41 species or 45, or there's a large number of species of bats in this area. And they said, so if somebody was to get bit by something, maybe, you know, and we've talked about it with rabies and people getting bit, and they've made movies about people getting rabies and all this. He said, you know, if they were to get bit out here, there was probably no treatment. So if something like that was to happen, maybe that's what you're dealing with, is maybe it's someone infected and all that. And they're like, people are like, no, man, they're not infected. Like this, I don't care. What is it, From Dusk Till Dawn? I don't care how crazy you are. Sunlight doesn't make you explode, right? No matter how crazy you are, you don't blow up in the sunlight. Well, oddly enough, they start talking about these, what they started calling the undead, would start showing up in the daylight hours. First, it was in the evenings, right? At dusk or at night. Then it's during the daylight. And they're like, look, they're not vampires. They can't show up during the daylight. So there's an area, there's a village that they believed was completely occupied by these things. And so they move in, they're going to burn it, they're going to attack it. These things scatter into the jungle, these whatever these creatures were. So at the time, morale is in the crapper. Everybody's, you know, down. And dude, you do not want morale to get down ever. Anybody listening to my voice knows what it's like when you work at a place with bad morale, right? Or you're on a team with bad morale. Like it's rough. It's real rough. So you definitely don't want that in any military setting. You want morale to be very high. So, you know, the Viet Cong, they're fighting back. Everything's going good. So they start bringing in some different agents. And because of what they've been hearing, the story goes that they bring in some of these vampire zombie association or whatnot agents. They bring the FVZA agents in, and they bring them in the end of 66 to be consultations for what they're dealing with in this forest. So the story goes that during the daytime battle between these undead and the U.S. troops, that the agents that they brought in noticed that the problem might not have been the fact that they were, you know, not just bulletproof, but that it's not a double canopy in this jungle. It's not a single canopy. It's a triple canopy, three-layer canopy that is filtering and blocking almost all of the sunlight. And you can pull up videos, and you can watch bushcrafter videos. You can watch them when they find them in the jungles. You can look at all of this jungle footage, and you can watch old Vietnam documentaries. You can tell just how dark that jungle can be because it's so, the canopy is so thick, right? And so they start believing that's what allows the undead to move during the daytime is because of the jungle canopy. So the story goes that that's when LBJ decided, you know what? This is what we're going to do. We're going to burn off and destroy the jungle. So they say, or, you know, the writers of this story and the way this story goes, say it's said that that's how the program got started with Agent Orange, that they started spraying Agent Orange to basically kill off as much acre of jungle to defoliate the canopy. And then the remaining groups were gone through and were burned. If they couldn't napalm them, they sprayed them with flamethrowers. They worked their way through. And of course, people my age, maybe not younger, but of course the people my age, and then if you've got family in Vietnam that were sprayed with Agent Orange where they've been affected by this, you know, but that's not good stuff. You don't want that stuff on you. It's never been good stuff. But there was like over 6 million acres of jungle, I believe, was killed off because of this stuff. So they sprayed millions and millions of gallons on this thing just so they could, you know, according to this, fight off the vampires that were in the jungles of Vietnam. So it makes you wonder just how accurate some of these Aswang vampires and some of these other vampire stories were, that maybe there's a lot more to it. Maybe there is a whole lot more to it. But before we go, I want to leave you with this. And it's a ghost plane story. A US P-40 fighter plane that was used to defend during the bombing of Pearl Harbor crash landed, folks, in the United States a year after the attack. There was no pilot found. The story says this, that back in December of 1942, that there was an unidentified plane that was picked up on American radar. And they gather it up and they're like, this is coming from Japan. So instantly they're like, hold up. Really? Like, we're doing this again, right? So they scramble two fighter planes, they get them up in the air, and they're going to intercept this plane. They come diving in on it. They radio back and they're like, this is a P-40, this Mustang. So this, and you can see some cool one of those at the World War II Museum too. And they said this hadn't been used since the defense of Pearl Harbor the year before. So here's what really makes it strange. As they get in there, there's bullet holes. They can see the bullet holes, right, on the side of this thing. They say that the landing gear won't come down, that it's not working. And they say that there's a pilot in the cockpit, and he looks like he's been shot. Fresh blood all over everything, the whole deal. So this is what they claim. They claim that the pilot rose up and waved at the other two planes just before it nosedived and was crashing. So it crash landed. So they found the wreckage. They bring it back in. There was no pilot after they found all this, right? No pilot at all. But they found a diary kept inside that plane. And they claim that this plane had flown from Mindanao, which is an island in the Pacific Ocean about 1,300 miles away. Now, what they say is so strange is if the pilot crash landed on this island after the Pearl Harbor attack, how did he live there for a year and then get the plane started again like it's no problem and fly it back? But why did he crash it? Why was he still bleeding? What shot him? How did all this happen? Or was this simply a time slip? Had this man only been missing from combat mere seconds before he reappeared? Because mind you, this took place on December 8th of 1942. A year and a day, and he reappeared. So, was he really stranded somewhere on a desert island? Or did he simply reappear after the battle? Whatever he was caught into, whatever maybe happened, and crash landed. I guess we'll never know, but it does make a very interesting story. And speaking of stories, I'm going to wrap this baby up. Thank you so much for listening. Let's take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk to Big Fizzy and see what he thinks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Kyle and I have discussed this off air before, is I wonder how many odd sightings, you know, like we always talk about, much like this with this one in the Civil War. It always seems like during combat times is when evil appears, right?
Yeah, they're
like
drawn to it.
Yeah, and you hear of these monster tales or these, and it could have easily been wolves or bears, or it could have been anything that was, you know, feeding on dead bodies at the time, whatever. But it does seem to peak. It's, you know, we do seem to have a lot of this darkness in, or these evil entities, rather, in these dark areas, much like what we talked about with the Mothman, with all of the murder and the crime going on up in Chicago. And that whole deal, it could be bleeding out of it with all the stuff that's going on, and it's like evil feeds on it.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's a very good theory, because there have been huge amounts of sightings of these flying winged humanoids.
Yeah.
In and around the Chicago area, and it is a very bad place for crime at this current point.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it seems like it's escalating a lot in different parts of the country and others, and it's just like the news is just not telling everybody about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just strange times. I think many years from now, we're going to look back at this time, 2020, 2021, and it's going to be like a very important time in history.
The same thing as we look back in the 1920s.
Yeah.
It's going to be the same deal. Hey, speaking of looking back, I've got something I want to share with you. I want to ask you about, because we go to Oklahoma, all of us, you know, we go to Oklahoma often, you know, we run up to Turner Falls, we run around all that mm-hmm. stuff. I was just in there a few weeks ago. Like, we got family up there. You and I have always, every time, you know, we go through Thackerville, we always laugh about it. That's Dog Man's in Thackerville. You just recently discussed about the Bigfoot in the dumpsters. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we get a lot of accounts from Oklahoma of a lot of hominid activity.
Yeah.
Especially the fact that Kyle and I are legitly, like, where we live, we're probably, what are we, barely in, we're maybe an hour and a half to the Red River.
Yes.
So, I mean, we're close, the Red River, and there's all kinds of sightings of stuff that goes up and along. And my good buddy Blake, he has a place there on the Red River where they hunt, and they got family land and this whole thing. And they see all kinds of, like, just wildlife. So I can imagine all the traffic up and down there that might be something else. So I wanted to share this with you because you've been to Waurika. Mm-hmm. So it says here recently, it says that I'm a truck driver based out of Texas. All right. His name's MN. And Lon emailed this to me. He says, on February 28th of 2021, I'm parked. This is at 2230 hours. I'm parked. Perhaps what would that be? 10 o'clock? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be 10:30, right? So I'm parked behind JW's travel stop in Waurika, Oklahoma, in Jefferson County, next to a field about 200 foot from a tree line doing paperwork. My dog, Bo, which is part wiener dog, y'all, is sitting in a passenger seat, and Bo begins to growl, ears back, hair on his back is up. I look over at Bo and then follow the direction of sight he's focused on, and I see walking along the tree line at a fast, steady gait, a 6-foot-plus tall Bigfoot with a thick, muscular build. It had black hair and beige-colored midsection. I watched it for a minute or so, then it turned at an opening in the trees and walked back out of my sight. I had zero desire to pursue it.
Good on you. Yeah,
that is decision. A excellent, excellent call. Good on you for not chasing the Bigfoot.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of Sasquatch sightings in and around the Red River.
It's crazy that it's that happening right there, right?
But it's a major waterway. So if they are moving and traveling, I mean, that's a great place to get it done, right?
I need to run it by my buddy Waldo. Waldo's, I'm going to have to ask him about it too. Him and Maze and all of those guys at the Nawak and all of that stuff too, with those guys that do, because don't they have a place up there in Oklahoma that we've talked to with?
That's Mike. Right. It's like the special Area X or something.
Yeah, Project
that'll,
X or that'll whatever.
Give the exact location, unless something. You're a member, right?
And the reason they chose it is because of all the activity mm-hmm. up there.
Yeah, I'd be curious. You know, like we talk all the time about not wanting to go ghost hunting and stuff. I would be curious to go on like a Bigfoot hunt, because I feel like it's in an area, no expert, mind you, but I am familiar with the woods. So I feel like I would at least have some kind of...
As we were running around in the dark. The one thing about all of us being out there with headlamps is everybody was packing. That was the best thing about it. No pigs were going to come slipping when we were tracking deer.
I didn't have a gun with me.
Oh, you didn't have yours?
No, I didn't have
you?
Nothing. I had a stick, a walking stick.
Oh, good. Then
but I knew everybody was around, so...
I'd have just shot you in the hip and left you.
Yeah, right.
That's how I look out for it. Anyway, folks.
Cool. Very cool.
Hope y'all enjoyed this week's episode.
Yeah, we're getting ready for Christmas soon.
Yep.
I've got one more gift to get, and then I'm done.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I can't say what it is because they might listen to the show.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I've only got a couple left, and I think I can order the stuff that I need to pick up now. Everything else that we wanted to get, we've received. So,
right,
everything's
on.
All well, that good stuff there. Yeah. If y'all like other creepy stories, like we talked about on the Elite Show, I'm going to be discussing portals to hell.
Oh, portals to hell.
Yeah. Apparently, there's a lot.
That's not good news.
And so it's not just one, folks. So you don't have to go wait in line. They're all over. Not only all over the U.S., they're all around the world. All around the world, same song.
Just the same
song. He passed away.
Who did?
Humpty.
He did?
The nose, yeah. Yeah, he passed away like, dude, earlier this year.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it came and went, man. Yeah.
Man. Humpty.
All around the world,
lost another one.
Same song.
Yeah, Tupac was actually in that band back in the day, right? Yep.
I think about it because I think of that old movie, Nothing But Trouble. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah.
How terrible that was?
But terrible. I thought that movie's pretty cool.
Chevy Chase, John Candy, Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
What's her face?
Demi Moore.
Demi Moore. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were several people. What is, man, God, I can't remember all the people that were in it now. But yeah, it was fun. But I always think of that song because they're all dancing in there.
What was the name of that group? The Digital Underground?
Digital Underground.
Yeah.
Baby.
Yeah. Shows our age, right?
My name is Humpty.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very cool. Speaking of cool, if you have any cool stories that you want to tell everybody, don't hesitate. Call the hotline, 888-393-2783. You can call in, and just like Jake did on today's episode, you might hear it on the show. If you don't feel like calling in, you can always email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can send us the story. Don't ask if we need permission. There's no need to ask. Just go ahead and send it. We love to read those stories.
We
want
to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't care how minuscule you think it is.
But please be thorough in your explanation, right?
But if you don't think, we still want to read it.
Yeah. And just like we always say, if you don't want your name used, dude, just make up an alias or tell us to make up an alias. Like the woman that wrote in, her name's not really Carol. And don't forget about our sponsor.
It is in my book.
Get your first bag free and $5 off your bundle at checkout. Just go to drinktrade.com/expanded and use the promo code expanded, EXPANDED. Take the quiz to start your journey to the perfect cup.
I love it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I love it,
yeah,
man.
Terrific service.
Yes.
Because I'm a big coffee guy. Cam, what do you got planned for your week? I know that college is wrapping up. I know that work is kind of wrapping up, so it's going to kind of slow down for the holidays. You got any big plans? Are you going out of town? Are you staying around here?
We're staying around here as far as I know. My daughter is back. So my daughter's back from college, and she's going to be here for a little over a month now.
Very good.
So it's good to have her back. Look, I give her a hard time because she was always, y'all know she was coming, you know, every couple of weeks. She would, you know, come back home and get stuff, change stuff, just come visit. We got a lot of stuff going on and all that, but it's good. I like having her around.
Sure.
I miss her, right? So I'm glad she's back. And then, you know, get to keep the grandbaby. We've got to hang out. So it's going to be grandbaby's first Christmas this year. So we're looking forward to it.
Has she gone and seen Santa yet? Got the Santa pictures?
I don't think so. I don't think she has yet. I think that's coming up. Well, so here's the thing. Her grandfather on her mother's side goes and does, he looks like Santa.
Oh, perfect.
So he does Santa impersonations and then he'll go and set up and then they'll do the, like he'll go and fill in for Santa whenever they're doing the parades, right? And he does all of this stuff. So he does that. So hopefully that's where she'll get her. That's probably where she's going to get her picture made.
Well, that would be easier.
Yeah.
Being a family member, you know, versus a stranger.
Yeah. So we're just looking forward to that whole thing. It's going to be weird. You know, this is the first year without my mother-in-law. So that's Thanksgiving was a little rough. And I know Christmas was always one of her favorite times. So it's going to be hard for the family. It's going to be very hard for the family this year. So we'll see how it all goes. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Don't have anything crazy planned.
Yeah, us either. So I think we're going to be knocking around here. But I know right after New Year's, January 2nd, we're going snowboarding up in Colorado.
You're heading north?
Yep.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to go, I think, sometime in February, I believe, is what we're talking
about. So looking forward to that. Always like road trips, getting away. And, you know, I like the winter weather.
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. Other than that, the rest thing that we're going to be doing is we got some more videos we want to shoot, and we're going to be hunting. That's pretty much it.
Awesome. Well, I hope everybody out there has a great week. Be safe. Give someone a hug. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.